Chapter 6. Model Friends. Waking up for the third time in as many chapters, Sean knew, from hardly one experience, to look first for the things that didn't make sense. And in this regard he struck it rich. The first discovery was that he was breathing. What made it strange was that he was underwater, in fact under so much of the stuff in every direction, that water had become a three-dimensional atmosphere that went all the way up to a shimmery, airy stratosphere. Yes, the world was definitely inverted. No less so than if you went out one morning and saw fishy marine-type creatures, calling themselves pteranauts, moving around on dry land with water snorkels, tanks, or long tubes reaching back into the sea or lakes, or a type of inside-out submarine full of water, so they could still breathe while they explored the heights of the inhospitable dry world. He moved his cold hands and arms, and found he had something on his chest as well as in front of his face, and further bloated finger feeling revealed this to be a mask of glass and leather, with a tube leading up from it. When he looked around, he found he was stand-bobbing on the deck of a sunken ship. Another rather curious thing, Sean noticed, was that on and around the wooden ship were a number of last convulsion-quality Roman soldiers being pulled down to their deaths by their exaggerated, weight-wise armor. It seemed to him that the Romans had the right idea, so he acquiesced to the wishes of the majority and joined the panic. Soon his struggling form was being pulled out of the water, and the world's very first diving rig pulled off his face and chest, to find himself happily enough coughing, gasping, and blinking into a welcome alternative cocktail of fresh air and sunlight. Voices were rebuking and soothing him simultaneously. "Did you find anything?" an old man asked keenly in a whisper by his ear. "Find what?" Sean spluttered back, and the accompanying gesture revealed that his right hand was involuntarily gripping something. "Ah, bravo." The old man seized the object and quickly stowed it somewhere in his robe. The man instructed the small crew of the boat they were on to hoist sail and head back to the shore. As this was being performed, Sean managed to calm down enough to register a few things. First, he seemed to be in the body of a boy of about his own 12 years. Secondly, the old man was not that old. His graying beard made him look more venerable than his just shy of 50 he turned out to be. The other men around them referred to him as maestro, master or teacher. By the time the boat docked, they were surrounded by gondolas, gracefully scurrying here and there like leaves jostling for a parking space in a storm drain. He followed in the train of the maestro and his assistants, alongside narrow canals, over footbridges, and across a pedestrian and stall-crowded piazza, up to a room with a view of a Venetian canal. Soon Sean was sort of dry, less underfed, and preliminarily rested. When he rejoined him, the maestro was bent over a work table. All around him were drawings, paintings, and wooden models of all sorts of things. The maestro was humming as he worked and muttered, "Ah, so much to learn, so much to do." Sean ran forward. "No, no." The man laughed and turned his bearded face to him.
"Not that I know of. You nearly drowned a young man to obtain this."
He was cleaning something with a cloth. Sean wiped away a tear he found skiing down the side of his nose. "What is it?"
"Ah, what indeed. It has had a long sleep under the sea. But unless I miss my guess, this little object has seen more of the world than any human being, except perhaps the polars themselves. Look."
The old man opened the cloth. What was there surprised Sean no end in sight.
"My watch."
"Your what?"
"I mean, my catch." "No, you definitely said my watch."
"Sorry, it's just that... Sorry, what is your name?"
"An impertinent boy you are."
"I really can't remember anything."
"Oh dear, perhaps old Leonardo has a remedy left in his travel chest. Perhaps a leech or two are still fresh. They're just the humours, they tell me. Although I find using them to be far from a laughing matter."
Sean read the name on the travel chest the old man was hunting through.
"Sir, you are Leonardo."
"Leonardo what?"
"Just a Leonardo. Less to remember."
"Not Da Vinci?"
"Yes,
replied Leonardo, turning to look at Sean a little too knowingly for the latter's comfort.
That is where I'm from.
I see, replied Sean. So this would be,
Oh, now, surely you know it is the year of the Grand Jubilee, 1500 Anno Domini, the 1500th anniversary of the invention of dominoes. And all the finest brains of Europe have come to Italy to join in the tree-nailing festival, as well as the entire French army. And that is why I am here in Venice. I had a really cushy post at the court of Ludovico Sforza, Duke of Milan. But then the French came, destroyed my giant horse model, used it as a target practice. Darn a shame I didn't get around to doing it in a bronze, but I think a terracotta has a lovely, well, earthy look to it. Took me ages to get the nostrils right. 12 years of hard work down the proverbial canalization.
How did you know the watch was on the sunken ship? Asked Sean.
I did, and I was trying out my new underwater anti-drowning apparatus on a U. I didn't know if it would work.
Thanks a bundle.
You're welcome, a bundle. How curiously you speak. It just happened to be where Marco Polo's ship sank. Extraordinary coincidence.
I'm beginning to believe nothing happens by coincidence.
You were doing fine, by which I mean you hadn't drowned her yet. Not like as the others.
The others?
Prototypes. And then you suddenly panicked and swam to the surface without inflating the bladders I instructed you.
I might have drowned, objected Sean.
Yes, and that would have been inconvenient. I'm afresh out of volunteers.
What was my watch doing on Marco Polo's ship?
In 1295, on his return from China, his ship sank in the lagoon under mysterious circumstances. According to his book, when his uncle told Marco about having seen an arm clock in China inscribed Sang Real, he became inflamed with the desire to find it. His uncle had terrible map-making skills for a traveller, and had forgotten where he had seen the watch. As a result, what should have been a quick trip east turned into a 25-year marathon for Marco Polo, his father and uncle. They combed every part of China and all the Far East for it, and when they did find it and brought it back to Europe after 15 centuries of exile, it ended up lying in 15 fathoms of water in the Venetian lagoon for 205 years.
Till this morning, nodded Sean. The watch drew me to it.
I see,
Leonardo said in the way we do when we don't. Because it belongs to me.
The Holy Grail belongs to you,
stammered Leonardo.
But why do you call it the Holy Grail?
Sean returned the stammer intact.
Well, how do you explain these markings on the back? See you there. Sang Real. Sang means blood, and Real obviously means royal.
The legend is usually marketed under the trade name of Santo Graal. Men have been searching for this ancient relic for over 1,000 years.
Why? It is reputed to contain Spiki Celesti, the language of the gods.
I see.
Shall I show you how it works?
Sean took the watch and made sure the photocell was clean. Then he laid it in the sunlight. It is definitely my watch, but if it has been underwater for 2 centuries, and for that matter bandied around Asia for more than a millennium, how could it be in such good condition? Suddenly the watch sprang to life, its little mouse figurine ticking joyfully away electronically, as if it were glad to see Sean. Sean pushed a button and showed Leonardo the planetarium mode, with the sun at the center and the planets rotating around it.
Most interesting. I must show this to that young Polish astronomer, Copernic, who is passing through Venice on his way to Rome for the tree-nailing festival. I am sure he will find this interesting.
Copernicus, the Polish genius who gives the West the heliocentric system of the solar system, putting the sun at the center of the orbiting planets?
Really? Well, it seems a young man. Did anyone ever get around to giving you a name?
Sean Solpierre.
Well, a younger Sean. It seems destiny is somehow in orbit around this watch, and you. Tell me, where you are from?
I'm from the future, the year 2010. Leonardo may or may not have battered an eyelid, as either would have been impossible to detect under his bushy eyebrows.
If you are from the future, why does this arm clock arise from the deep past?
And so Sean explained the whole story, or at least the parts he felt he had some handle on, which didn't take long. When he had finished, Leonardo stood with sudden lively decision.
I think, younger Sean, we need to undertake a journey. "'We must return to your home.'
"'I'm going home,' cried Sean in delight, tears filling his eyes.
"'First, I must show this watch to Copernicus, and then we leave.'
To slip by the French army, Leonardo and Sean drove their small cart by a route which skirted the southern edge of the Alps. Throughout the journey, Leonardo asked question after question of Sean concerning the world he came from, what vehicles there were, whether machines fought war for humans, how much medicine had changed, the price of leeches, and some useful tips about avoiding queues to airports on holiday weekends. Leonardo insisted on writing everything down, beautifully illustrated, in his famous mirror handwriting, right to left. This required them to stop frequently, and involved a lot of mirror polishing, so the journey, which Sean had once done with his father in 3 hours on the 6-lane horseless carriageway, turned into a week. But the most enjoyable week of Sean's life, or at least coming close to rivaling the week he had spent alone with Nonno touring Europe's best science museums. So well did Sean feel, he actually called Leonardo Nonno again accidentally. When this week had finally exhausted the road's length, but not Leonardo's curiosity, they arrived at Lugano, and Sean's heart leapt. Lugano incorporates a bay on the north coast of a long lake, contorted into a strange squirrel shape by the mountains.
"We are but a half a day's ride from Milan, where I lived and worked for 17 years. Here in Italy, 17 is considered unlucky, which I guess is the case."
"Why do you say that, maestro? Milan is where you painted The Last Supper, and did many of your other most famous works."
"Nicer of you to say so, Sean. I had given up a hope that any of them had survived the French invasion."
They passed through the town of Lugano, very little of which Sean recognized. Even the shape of the lake shore was yet to be straightened enough for traffic to race by and be oblivious to, so its banks lay adorned with the living evidence of fishermen, their boats croqueted with their distinctive wire-hoop awnings, and nets festooned on stakes to dry. If it weren't for the easily identifiable mountains around the lake basin, and perhaps one or two of Lugano's oldest buildings, now impossibly fresh and new, Sean wouldn't have known where he was. Leonardo turned the horse's head away from the lake towards the line of mountains to the north of Lugano. Sean's pulse quickened as they moved towards the north of the little town, and by easy triangulation to the peaks and distance from the lake, Sean realized they would soon be more or less where his home would be in 500 years. And as they turned into a strip of flattened terrain, which, if the season so consented, served as a road, he saw it, the haunted house, looking regal and aloof, out on its own amongst its feudal fields.
"Why are you bringing me to this house, Maestro Leonardo?" asked Sean, as pleased as he was bewildered.
"Because this villa is the holiday home of my client, Francesco del Giocondo, and his wife, Madonna Lisa. My Lady Lisa is very charming and beautiful. I have also invited a friend of mine, a mathematician called Luca Pacioli. It should be an entertaining couple of months here."
"Couple of months?" Sean was beyond happiness. He was home with Leonardo, to whom he was growing as attached as he was to Nonno, which made the thought of the 500 years that separated them a little more bearable. Lisa and Francesco exchanged salutaries warmly with Leonardo, and reacted with mixed pleasure and surprise on seeing Sean. The young and handsome Francesco scolded Leonardo.
"Your idea of sliding down a mountain on wooden slats leaves a deficit of desire, Leo."
"Perhaps I neglected to emphasize you should do it in a winter when there is a snow."
"Ah," coughed Francesco, embarrassed.
Lisa smiled wickedly at her husband's foolishness. Leonardo gasped.
"Oh, I have got to dash off a snap portrait of that smile of Madonna Lisa."
And in so doing, Leonardo had secured for them an invitation to stay while Il Maestro painted the portrait of La Gioconda, a nickname, Sean thought up, which translates roughly as the teaser. While Leonardo was setting up an improvised painting studio on the balcony of the haunted house to make use of the splendid backdrop of lake and mountains, Lisa pulled Sean to one side, and whispered, "Sean, it's me, Jenny."
"Jenny!" Sean leapt to hug her. "Hey!" shouted Francesco. "Keep your dirty Venetian paws off my wife."
Sean stopped dead. But when Jenny winked at him, he turned and called, "Pow!" And they reunioned too, albeit several notches further down on the enthusiasm scale.
"But how long have you been here?" stammered Sean.
"We came to meet Leonardo on our way through the timeline, as we always do," said Jenny. "We didn't expect to see you. What a wonderful surprise. I'm so happy you got away."
"Without scraping through, so to speak," added Pow, relishing the memory of Sean on the flaying rack.
"Leonardo was late this time," he said, looking at Sean suspiciously.
"And where are the others?" asked Sean.
Pow explained in his show-offish manner.
"Oh, a Moor stayed back in 1485 to pose as Venus for Botticelli. Her clam to fame, you could say. Gorgeous." He said this obviously to make Jenny jealous. "We're models, being so perfect and all."
"You're models?" exclaimed Sean.
"That's why we're here, idiot. Jenny wants to be the Mona Lisa again, little egotist."
"Don't you talk, pal. You're scheduled to be Mick the Angel's Davide soon. Great buttocks," she scandalized.
"And Elf?" Sean asked.
Pow pointed to a small pile of time eggshells on the balcony they were on. "Elf got bored waiting for Leo, so went on ahead to 1508, Rome, to pose for you-know-who as Adam on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel."
"Who are these Mick the Angel and you-know-who?" asked Sean.
Jenny answered, "The same. Never say the M word in front of Leo. He gets incredibly jealous of." She whispered the name, "Michelangelo."
"These are things a termite larva like you would know nothing about," snubbed Pow. Sean stood up to him.
"Oh, really? So, is that all time riders do? Just ponce around through time and take all the best modelling jobs?"
"We are more than just queue jumpers. Our job is..."
"Yes?"
"To inspire," finished Pow with crushing superiority.
This hadn't sounded as finalistic as Pow had intended. After the silence had hung uncomfortably for a while, Sean turned to Jenny and said, "Could I be one too?"
"Sure," answered Pow, thumbing an imaginary catalogue.
"There's an opening in 1893 for Edvard Munch's Skrik, The Scream."
"Don't tease him so, Pow. Poor Sean."
"Poor Sean,"
Pow tried to mock, but stopped abruptly.
"I miss him, Jenny. Where is Stinto?"
"Sean, we can't find Stinto,"
added Jenny with a worried frown that washed away her Mona Lisa demurity entirely. Sean bit his lip before saying, "I have to tell you something. When you all left Archimedes' house, Stinto didn't. For some reason, he didn't jump when he broke the egg. Do these eggs ever go off?"
"A bad time egg."
"Never happened before," retorted Pow.
"What did he do then, Sean?"
"He tried to get to the Oracle. He knew she had an egg."
"Of course she did." Pow was getting angry in response to his worry. "All oracles have them. How else can they see the future, you widget?"
"But the Romans got him. This is terrible. They speared him, then connected a helmet to the spear, and I think I saw him pass into the helmet. Then later, that Roman consul guy, Cespuglio, put the helmet on, and I heard Stinto again briefly. He told me to warn you."
"Warn us? What about?"
Jenny took Pow's hand, frightened. Sean closed his eyes and thought.
"He said, warn them. Tell Jenny the invertebrates are here."
Pow threw back rudely. "Not invertebrates, you driftwood barnacle. Invertebrates."
Jenny squeezed Pow's hand hard, tears welling in her eyes.
"Who are these invertebrates?" asked Sean.
Jenny answered in a small voice,
"We don't know, but we know what it means if they appear on our timeline. Something is going wrong with time. We have suspected it for some time now."
Pow had by now abandoned all pretense to control.
"Since you appeared, to be precise. What did I always tell you, Jenny? It is Sean. He is the cause of all this."
"No, Pow, we don't know that for sure."
"Oh, yes? Something has changed, hasn't it? Everything is the same as every time we pass through the timeline, except this measly little time flea."
Jenny bit her lip and shook her head. "And the invertebrates?" They have come to eliminate him, Jenny, can't you see? It is obvious that he is the cause of it all. Then why did they let me go? Blurted out Sean. Powell pointed at Sean with disgust and anger. Aha! That is as good as an admission. I see through you. You betrayed Stinto to get his egg. You killed him. Sean, in the guise of a young boy, backed away from the tall and angry young man. No, Jaspulio said you can't be killed, only captured.
Captured? What does that mean, you little bubonic plague carrier?
That is what the helmet is for, to capture the shrouds, to use their abilities.
Abilities?
What would they want with them? They can't use them, can they, Jenny? Powell sounded unsure. Jenny was trying not to cry.
I don't know, Powell. I'm so frightened. Oh, I wish Amua would hurry up and get here.
What I can't understand is why she hasn't arrived yet, asked Sean. If she stopped off in the past, then surely that doesn't mean she can't be here now, in the future? Jenny answered. Amua insisted on stopping off to try again to be Venus for Botticelli. She missed out last time round because her agent got the plague and took the rest of his life off. She should have been here by now. I'm worried. What is going on?
Leonardo came in at this juncture with a freshly sharpened brush. If he had overheard any of the conversation, all he said was,
Sean, could you please find some pinky brown pigment to mix in with the paint?
What about these eggshells?
Yes, they should do quite nicely.
While Sean was grinding up the thyme eggshells and mixing them into the paint base, Powell left to check if Amour had arrived in town. Jenny whispered out of the side of her mouth while still posing for Leonardo.
Please, Sean, you mustn't blame Powell for being how he is. He is aggressive because he is fearful by nature.
If Powell embodies fear, said Sean, what about you? Are you the embodiment of beauty?
That is sweet of you to say that, but beauty is not an entity. Beauty comes to all of us when we are together. We miss Stinto. We feel an emptiness where he should be. We need his instinct.
I don't think it is right for you guys to go around in time and take advantage of everybody, posing as the perfect example of humans.
But, Sean, that is our job.
Leonardo threw down his brush irritatedly.
Please, Madonna Lisa, I need you to keep still. Now your eyes and your mouth are all a-blurred.
Sorry, maestro.
Actually, I don't mind the effect. Kind of, smoky, sfumato, I think I'll call it. But please stay still, like the last time.
Like last time?
Jenny was surprised.
You mean, you remember?
Now, be a good girl and give me that foxy smile that will have a Paris in an uproar.
Jenny stared at him.
Leonardo, you are really the most remarkable of men.
Still, please, he answered seriously, but Sean could see the ends of his mouth curving into a smile.
Of course, maestro.